This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
So we're formally going to get started in a formal way. So welcome, everyone. Thank you so much for coming.
And since we're a more intimate group, if you want to move up, you're welcome to do that.
Or if you don't, you're fine where you are. Before we get started, I did want to say that the music tonight comes from our very own record label, Textual Records.
Is that yours?
And a lot of our product is in the back there, along with our catalog that we'll be discussing tonight. So basically, let's see, what we just heard on the way in was a Prelude to a Memory, a 7-inch that's a part of our most recent film that was featured at the ICA, and that contains amazing hits like Washington Post March and William Tell Overture, but done with a Norteño Conjunto. Via the accordion. So that's, and these are all stocking stuffers, by the way. and then before that, we heard, what do we hear? We heard If a Song Could Be Freedom, a project that Textual Records did with the Interference Archive with five international workers, bass songs, really great. 7-inch. And then before that was Sense Objects, a project with Stephen Vitello and Leah Bieferman. And then also White Rabbit by Kristen Oppenheim. And this one's really cool because it comes with a fold-out poster that she designed. And it's also a 12-inch gatefold. So yeah, it's all in the back, and help yourself. Now I'm going to give the mic to Valerie.
Hi. Thank you all for coming. So we'll start out with some thank yous, and thank you. Thank you, Sina and Cabinet, for hosting our launch here tonight. We were really excited to have it here because we're big fans of Cabinet, and so it's really nice to be here. We'd like to thank Kate Craxon, who is at the end of the table. She is the associate curator at the ICA Philadelphia. And, I mean, there's so many things to talk about, which we'll do tonight. But, you know, we've had such a productive and an intense conversation over 7 years and collaboration. And you know, your vision for curating the show and organizing the book as well, I think, is really inspiring to us. Also, it's been really incredible working with you and the ICA team, so kudos to the ICA, if any of you are there, here, on the other end of the video camera. And also to, again, to Kate and Karen Tongson, and to Susan Glassman and Lynn Dorwalt for their illuminating texts, which are included in the book that we hope you all get a chance to take a look at. It's in the back as well. And many thanks to Tom and Jessica of Everything Studio for designing such a beautiful book. We're, you know, completely inspired by that. We feel that you've responded to our work in a very generous and impactful way. And we were awed when we first received the advance copy of the book, and, you know, thank you again. And I'd like to, you know, so I'm like, it'll be a half an hour of thanks here, but
cue
that's what happens. Also, I would like to, you know, mention my department at the College of Staten Island, CUNY, the Department of Media Culture, and the Division of Humanities and Social Sciences. My dean is here today. And thank you for giving me or agreeing to my sabbatical last year. Because without it, we would have never been able to finish the film, mount the exhibition, and the catalog. So thank you, Nan. So from there, All right, we're done with the thanks. And we just wanted to mention the slides behind us that are circulating are images that are from exhibition installation images from the ICA show, along with detail shots of the various projects interspersed with the ways in which they look in the book. And they're not organized in any sort of chronological way, but more following the flow of the exhibition at the ICA, and also the flow of the book, which Tom and Jessica will talk about in a moment. But given that, I thought we'd open it up to Kate so she can talk more about the exhibition and our collaboration.
Great. So it's really wonderful to have Stamatina Gregory in the audience tonight, because back in 2009, that's how long ago. So I joined ICA in 2008, and I was asked to curate a video show very quickly. And I, of course, Stamatina and I are always bouncing artists back and forth, but she's such a generous person, and I feel like I learned generosity early on as a young curator from Stamatina, because a lot of curators hold their cards close to their chest and don't share artists, but she did that from the beginning. And Stamatina recommended Valerie Nonho's work to check it out, and I did, and I fell in love with it. And I showed Touching from a Distance in that exhibition, and it got such wonderful feedback. And it was an exhibition where we didn't have video streaming constantly. We had a different video screened each week. And I had several curators and artists tell me that that was the highlight. There were some wonderful pieces in that show, but that was the highlight. And I loved their work so much that I just, you know, you, as a curator, you just put them on a list of artists you want to work with and that you want to do projects with in the future. And I just waited for an opportunity to arise. And so I won't get into details, but there were two grant project type opportunities that happened in Philadelphia. And we were not rejected from either of those. In fact, it wasn't the right fit, I guess, is the way to phrase it. And so Valerie and Angel were able to use their Creative Capital grant ultimately to do a project that came out of one of the original grant exhibition festivals that was happening in Philadelphia that matched artists to some of the incredible spaces we have in the city. And so the Wagner Free Institute of Science was something that my husband actually had been a member of and a donor to since he was in his early 20s and could only give them probably $20 a year, $25 a year as a bike messenger, I think at that time after college. And now, you know, we were real donors to that institution, but it's this wonderful Victorian natural history museum that is in its original state, including the original calligraphy on a lot of the cards, the original taxidermy, as you can see from some of the wonderful photos that we'll cycle through. Taxidermy technology has really improved since that time, but it's charming. One of my favorite pieces is actually in this slideshow, the cat with the
lynx.
The rodent,
yeah,
lynx.
The lynx.
Looks a little wonky. But the institution was also special to me because of its mission, which was to provide and still does provide free graduate level education to the Philadelphia public. And this was instituted in 1855 by William Wagner. And that was a real sense of public. According to their archive, and we checked with the archivist when we worked on this project, it was regardless of class, gender, race, that education was open to everyone, and they still offer classes, and that's still the core. So the Victorian Museum is really cool, and they get a lot of requests that are turned down. I think she turns down virtually everything, everyone who asks to shoot in the museum, because she doesn't. The director Susan Glassman, who wrote a wonderful piece for the catalog, doesn't necessarily want the museum to just be seen as this cool background set, like movie set situation. So our project, she said, was the first that she had seen in a long time that captured the core mission of the institution, which was to reimagine what publics were, or be more inclusive about what public even means in Philadelphia. And the reason that we brought that conversation into the project is because of Valerie and Angel's already ongoing research into the accordion. And I think Tina gave it the wonderful term specimen. The accordion is a specimen, which really linked to the Wagner's collection, a specimen the diaspora of the accordion around the world as something that traced all of our families. I think on one of the grant proposals we said, Stamatine is Greek, I have Ukrainian, Polish, Italian, Northern Mexican, and which is where the Norteño music that's such a big part of Memory of a Time Like Twice Lived comes into play. Yeah. Like, I could just go on and on about Memory of a Time Twice Lived, which was, again, funded by Creative Capital, but then the wonderful thing happened at ICA, which is I've been trying to get mid-career. What was the terminology you didn't
Survey. No, mid-career, I you think. Like yeah, yeah. Career. Survey
a
was
a survey right. show. And space opened up for us to do a survey show almost directly after the debut of Memory of a Time Twice Lived.
Yeah.
So it was just such a wonderful kind of experience to be able to transition right into showing the Philadelphia public your work after the wonderful events that we had at the Wagner. So the other thing I have to add is that the Wagner does not allow public music performances in their space because, again, Susan gets asked all the time if bands can play because it's such a cool-looking space. They've received a wonderful grant to redo the seating, so it's all original Victorian seating where you can actually put your top hat in a slot underneath each chair. And there are specimens all over the lab desk that's up at the front.
Yeah,
and
we'll come up on some images soon, yeah.
So we received, with the fact that we could have a live performance there was incredibly special and unique, and a lot of people told me they hadn't seen music performed live or knew of music being performed there live in 10 years. So we had a packed house, and you heard some of the live music earlier tonight when Angel played that. And I'm sure it'll be spun again tonight. But I guess I should transition to, if you want to add anything, I could go on and on and like go straight into the exhibition, but.
Well, just a couple of things to add. I think, well, that's interesting because we didn't know that they weren't interested in music performances at all. Basically, we were searching through their archives and, you know, looking at the various specimens and slides that existed in their archives as well. And we came across a number of programs from the late 19th century in which there were music performances held in the Wagner. And we said, wouldn't it be great to like redo some of these songs, but you know, in a style that has some sort of accordion component to it. We were particularly thinking of Norteño music. And we approached them based upon that, and they were really interested in that. Also, it was around the 150th anniversary of the museum, and so it seemed like a really nice fit to hold this kind of concert there and, you know, and talk about, you know, the new publics also of Philadelphia, I think, which was a part of that.
I think we drove down to the Italian market early on one of your trips when we were still thinking about sites, and I had told you that Norteño music is all over the Italian market because it is... the neighborhood that a lot of Mexican immigrants are moving to, and also Asian, and also that Philadelphia's census had increased for the first time in 30 or 40 years, and Pennsylvania as well, and that's because of Latino and Asian immigrants. So the city was actually growing, and new, I think 90%, almost 90% of new business license in the city of Philadelphia is from immigrants, actually, at this point. So the city is vibrant, and the neighborhoods are changing, and we had this wonderful dialogue at that time about how you can map the shifting demographics of neighborhoods based on the music that you hear coming out of homes and cars and businesses. Mm-hmm. And so, and the Italian neighborhood hadn't always been that either. And so there's this history there that we were really trying to draw into the project. Sorry to interrupt you, but.
Well, that's great. I mean, we totally tried to steer away from the whole Rocky theme going through the Italian market. So that was one of the clips in our film, and we totally bagged that idea. And that's just kind of some of the back end artistic creative stuff that I'm talking about right now. But Rocky. I would like to maybe bring in Tom and Jessica a little bit because, you know, they saw our exhibition at the ICA in Philadelphia. And I don't know, we've been working with them for a long time. They designed the 7-inch Sense Objects with Stephen Vitello and Leah Bieferman,
and
as
Regine.
Well as the our 7-inch Prelude to a Memory. So all this was designed by them, and there's some other things that we can attribute to them as well. But I'm just curious to hear from them, like how they translate a kind of three-dimensional space or exhibition experience into a book, because you guys had a lot of ideas for this.
Yeah, well, when we went to see the show, we'd already had meetings with you, and we'd spoken a little about how we're going to tackle the book. And I don't think either of us had a particularly strong vision of what to do. And you know, sometimes when you do a book for an artist, it's like there's one idea, you come up with it, and it's just about achieving that one idea. But with you guys, it was just something that kind of evolved over time. To begin with, we were thinking about the idea of just, you know, because a lot of your work deals with karaoke or you know, cover versions, that sort of thing. We're thinking about the idea of maybe, I don't know, typefaces and how you know, some message could be reinterpreted just by its visual form through typography and that sort of thing. And it was just a very loose cluster of ideas. And it was only when we went to see the show in the ICA that things really came into sharper focus for us. And one of the ideas that we'd been talking about was just the idea of just of a black book. I think you guys like the idea of a book about the size of like a video, a VHS video or something like that. You like the idea of a wee book. And I think maybe it's just because, you know, with video stills, it's like it seems a little odd to have an enormous book with, you know, video stills blown up large. I'm not sure, but we're thinking small. Wee black book. And then when we saw the show, it was we were just kind of walking around, and everything was very sort of in very dark and shady, and with little videos popping up here and there, and that was the sort of genesis of the idea for the book, where everything would just be in black tones.
And we wanted to organize it so that it followed sort of the progression of the show, where you're walking, you know, you see a screen, and then you turn around and you get the next video, you turn around and you see the next. So the book, the chapters are sort of sequenced that way, as if you're walking from room to room. I mean, we were really, really inspired by the show. It was incredible.
We didn't really want we didn't really want a neutral container too. There's something which we wanted that, you know, each section in the book has, you know, it veers off in various directions and different typographic styles or different rules that sometimes relate to the way that things are installed. So if you have a video with two things happening on either side, a split screen, then, you know, obviously you have a double page spread which kind of mirrors that. And it almost turned into a kind of a game where each project had a certain set of rules that you're kind of...
Each project?
Exactly.
Right, so there's a couple of questions I have then. So one of them is this idea of, like, time, you know, sequential. Like, how do you work with moving image, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Right, and you kind of solved that dilemma with the Blinded by the Sight project, where you had multiple screens on one image kind of depicting their time in the video. So I thought that was really brilliant. The other one is what you did with another protest song, Karaoke with a Message, with the lyrics and text. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious if you can expand on that a little bit.
That was... I'm trying to think. Well, the first one you mentioned was interesting, because that first instance was I think that was the first thing that we showed you, where it was just a row of images sequentially next to each other, where mm-hmm. you get to see the Morse code, the flashing light, but the karaoke, I can't even remember what our thinking was.
Well, I think we felt like that the song choices were key, mm-hmm. And that if just to bring the image, you know, make the images sort of come alive,
And we love the idea of showing many images from different locations that are, you know, regardless of the location, it's just capturing the spirit of these people. You see in the photography, these people are just sort of lost in their song. Mm-hmm. And right next to it, you see it's Cher, or it's, you know, mm-hmm. And you can sort of imagine yourself in those moments.
Yeah, I thought that was really key in adding the titles and of the song along with the artist and then the location, because it did kind of show across a geographic space as well, like where this project had taken place. Because it's this performance project that happens every once in a while. We're going to do it in the day after the election, so that'll be interesting. In the financial district, and so it's had its life in different geographies, different locations, even languages, and I think that was really key to showing that project having these multiple lives and the kind of songs choices that people had made. So the project is another protest song, Karaoke with a Message, where Angel and I have curated a karaoke songbook to songs that are particularly protest songs and songs that are recontextualized for the framework of the project. So they could be, you know, as you said, a Cher song, or, you know, something from the Eagles, or a contemporary song by Taylor Swift that might have a transformative potential to it. And that's how we're thinking of the possibilities of protest. So. And it's interesting too, because every time we mount that project, there's the song list or the choices are completely different, right? You know, it's all dependent upon chance, who decides to participate at that time, and the song choice that they've made, and it's really wonderful because we rarely have the same song sung over and over again, and you know, the songbook is about like 4,000 songs or so, yeah. But I guess this segues, we can go back to the exhibition as well, because maybe we go back and forth between the exhibition and the book. Sure. And then, and Kate, maybe you can talk a bit about your ideas toward the exhibition design and, you know, the kind of curatorial premise of the show too.
Yeah, I think that the checklist for the exhibition was I think mutually agreed on. We both had works that we really wanted to see in. And I wanted, because, you know, we're a public institution, and even though a lot of the people that I want to reach are the cabinet reading crowd, I also think about my parents and what they would experience if they went to one of my exhibitions. So dealing with artists that, you know, have done video and sound primarily, I wanted the first thing that a viewer sees to be an object-based work, even though it was a sound piece. So the slide with the radio and the stadium seating, that was the first room that you walk into. And, you know, it's like a curator trick. You want the sight lines of the first experience in an exhibition to be really strong, because that's going to set the tone for how people experience the work as well. But our high space, this was something that we did negotiate and have a long conversation about, because we put three video works in one room that absolutely could not have, in my opinion as a curator, multiple sound sources at once, even if we built walls, if we tried to build ceilings. So I've thanked them before, but I want to thank them publicly for trusting me as a curator to really insist that these three works be shown chronologically clockwise around the room. So you could sit on these, we call them the buttons, these button poofs, and the works would screen, and we worked with a wonderful tech at ICA, so it was pretty seamless. I mean, I thought that it looked fantastic. Yeah. But I also, as a curator, wanted the screens to be different. I didn't want it to be just, you know, we didn't want it to look like an installation, a singular installation. So the Touching from a Distance was screened on the wall from a projector. Blinded by the Sight was on a big, beautiful flat screen, and anyone who's worked in a museum knows you claim the biggest, nicest screen as early as possible. So as soon as we put the show on the books, I was like, I get that. And CC'd like all the other curators. And I think another curator just bought the same exact screen for their show downstairs, but they had the budget for it. And the war song was the one that didn't have a specific screening medium from the artist. So Valerie and Angel, we talked about ways to project that, and I thought to just differentiate it from touching from a distance, we'd kind of have a floating corner screen so that it also didn't seem like a big box. Mm-hmm. And I think it worked out really well. Yeah. Paul and our crew, we have a great preparator and crew, did a beautiful job, I think, on that piece. So you could just sit in there and watch one after the other. And a lot of people did. I was really happy with that because, as we all know, people don't stay. Your average museum visitor doesn't stay for videos. And so then there was another black box, which is where we had Memory of a Time Twice Lived, which is more of a cinematic. It's I think it's 33 minutes?
35
minutes. Mm-hmm. And then a sound piece in our ramp space, which is a very hard space to curate because it's just a ramp that goes diagonal and back and forth. But it worked extremely well, I thought, and was a nice way to end the show. So that was just my take on how to experience the space. So you're in darkness, then you're in light, then you're in light, then you're in darkness, and then you're in light. So it's not like a lot of video and sound-based shows. You go into these exhibitions and you're just in the dark for 4 hours. And then I also, we put how long the entire show was at the beginning so that as a viewer, if you're going to experience this entire show, it's going to take you, I think it was an hour and 30-something minutes, so that people are aware of that. And we're free, and you can leave and come back. And, I mean, that's what I tell myself, at least, that if I was charging $25 to get in, I would feel bad about that much time needed to see a show.
I really appreciated that because that I haven't seen that so often in exhibitions previously, you know. So at least as a viewer, then we have, you know, we're given the information ahead of time so we can decide to commit fully or not, or say, okay, I can come back another day and watch the other pieces as well. Right. And I think that that's really important for time-based work because sometimes, you know, you walk in and you're seeing the show, you know, on the last week of the exhibition, which I'm sure so many of us have done, you know, and realize that, you know, you need more time in the space as well. So to have that prefaced in that way, I thought was really key. And also to go back to the first room with the three pieces, you know, I think we had like a number of back and forth and discussions as to, okay, how might we rework this in a different way? Or maybe we just have two of the works there. But I think in the end, you know, we did, through the discussion around creating these different spaces within the exhibition space for each piece, that we were able to isolate each one of them, I think, in a really, really good way. Because, as you said, you know, we were concerned that people would read it as an installation, which sometimes happens, you know, when you have multiple videos in the same space. But I think by, you know, creating these different kind of screening contexts for each of the works, it worked really well.
Yeah. Right. And also allowing for a really good sound system in that room rather than three quieted, smaller speakers.
Yeah, and you know that we hate to use headphones, right? So...
Although we're working on a piece for headphones right now, which is funny. Yeah. Like, specifically, it's a headphone piece, so it's kind of funny.
But, I mean, we have a lot of curators and sound artists in the audience, and we know how tricky it is to mount an installation with sound work when you don't want to use headphones, but you want it to be experiential as well as a kind of time-spatial process, right? So... But I think, Kate, with the kind of sequential ordering of things with the video, I thought that worked out well. And then we had sound just kind of coming out of this beautiful German Grundig radio, which I thought kind of worked well as far as containing its own.
And because of the neurotransmitter history, I loved that the radio was the first thing people saw as well, because it was a nod to that.
Yeah, well, thank you. So we're bringing up all these names of projects without really giving you full context, so you can then go to the book and figure out what we were talking about, or go to our website.
Well, your website's wonderful because a lot of the videos are fully available.
Yeah, on Vimeo, we have...
Which is unusual for video artists. You always have to ask for the Vimeo password.
Yeah. Yeah, we're artists on demand, right? let's see. Did we cover all the bases?
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, we said we were going to speak for about a half an hour.
Yeah
so let's open it up
you
to
speak.
Questions.
Regine?
I have a question for Jessica. And first, before I say the question, I wanted to applaud you on the exhibition design because I thought it was fantastic. I'm really tuned into exhibition design, and I love when things have a rhythm to it, and I really felt like it reflected the concerns of their work. Which ultimately is what you want to happen. You want the exhibition to be so seamless with what the concerns of the work are that you feel like it felt like a collaborative thing that happened. It had this flow and rhythm, and it allowed for you to understand that a lot of the works are research-based and process-based, that there's time put into the backstory of it, and all of that came across. So, congratulations. Now, as I'm looking at these slides, a question comes to mind that I really never thought of before, and it's the issue of text in your work, because there is a lot of textual information. Textual records is, it's a big part of the work as well. Mm-hmm. How you represent the text with the piece, mm-hmm. And I've noticed that you always choose to go the route of really simple, really, in terms of the dialogue in parlay or another protest song, it's like a bibliography. There's a very spare representation of the information vis-a-vis the project. And I'm thinking as designers, so you had text as artwork, and then text as text, and then text as titles, and then text, and maybe you deal with this a lot, but I'm curious how you get into that.
The texts that come at the front of the book that are essays about the exhibition, we treated as almost like pages that were scanned, taken from another source.
We were talking about, in libraries, the microfiche, where everything's reversed. Right. That was just...
We didn't want it to look like it was us designing it. It was just someone gave us this text. We put these pages in. And the text that within their projects, where there were screenplays or in parlay, where you have this conversation, it was the same thing. We wanted it to feel like it was just sort of... I don't want to say part of the artwork, but again, almost we didn't have a choice in... we didn't have a hand in it.
That's a really important thing for us when we design a book, where we actually sometimes we try and kind of suppress our voice. When we work with an artist, it's usually that we agree to a set of parameters, some kinds of rules that we think that this is going to be an interesting way to present their work. And then once those decisions have been made, then it's almost like we've got this structure to work in, and there's no getting out of it, and we're just trying to see how, in each section, how we can kind of pull it in a different direction. It was important to us that the book was kind of heterogeneous, that's something which we sort of saw in their work, and that it wasn't just one thing. But at the same time, something we're very sensitive about is not expressing too much of our own voice, it not being about us. It has to feel more like it's coming from them somehow. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's always a difficult balance, though. I mean, with that record for the Leah Beefman, Stephen Vitello record, The Sense Objects one. That was, you know, that was us at our most minimal, you know, absolutely suppressing ourselves, you know, like to where it's, but you know, actually when you look closely on that, on the details of that record, there's little, we allow ourselves tiny moments of pleasure, you know, where you know, the record label with the, you know, the fine print, you know, we did something funny with that, didn't we? And yeah. Or like we actually came up with an incredibly elaborate website for that, which yeah. nobody asked us to do. We just did it because, you know, we have to do something fun, you know. Yeah. No, but you know what I mean? You know, it's like we'd constrained ourselves so much that it's almost like that actually when you aren't given that much freedom, you know, it becomes really powerful when you do have these moments of expression.
And to go back to, you know, thinking about some of the things that happened in the book and some of the choices that you were making, I remember the our conversations about like printing techniques or the ways of applying different kinds of layering of, you know, on top of images. So for instance, the images, and I thought that was really key within the book. Images that were production images. They wanted to add some sort of filter or some sort of kind of print or dot matrix pattern to it. And so we talked a lot about that, and we said, okay, well, that's an interesting idea, but we don't work with print so much. So what if you think about it in terms of video? So, you know, like the striations of video, because we loved the dot matrix, you know, that kind of printing or I don't know, I'm not using the right term. The halftone, yeah. And, you know, but then it felt like it didn't make sense with the images. But then the video kind of striation worked so well. And so that was a really interesting kind of conversation and collaboration that we had with you, you know, the discussions that happened as we were building the book, too. Yeah.
And I have to add that I'm officially the only curator at ICA who's not a complete printing book collector geek. They all have their own imprints and do books on the side, but then they tease me because they're like, you know, your books might be the best ones at ICA because you completely trust your designers. And they're like, that looks great, sounds great, oh yeah, that paper. But they kept telling me, you know, Anthony, my chief curator, he trusted you as well, but he's like, it's really hard to do this much black and do right. these layers, and every time I've tried to do that, it comes off on your fingers and it smears. And it came, and so all the book nerds were like, it's not coming out on our fingers at all. It was like this mastery as designers. You knew where to print it.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's such a beautiful book.
Yeah. Thank you. So are there other questions?
Oh yes, and there's a the Black Lives Matter movement in Philadelphia, and affiliated organizations are moving to take that statue down. Not that mural, but there's a statue of him. So he's a obviously very contested image person.
I just thought it was ironic to have the Mexican accordionist standing in front of Rizzo, who was so conservative and law and order and sort of anti-immigration and so I don't know, was that intentional to have that?
Yes.
Of course. Yeah. It was great. Juxtaposition.
Well, and the interesting thing that I think happens also with that shot, because the shot previous to that one was, we were actually in Mexico, and so then we returned to Philadelphia at that point. And I think for people who aren't familiar with that mural, it also creates this interesting kind of spatial confusion as well, because, you know, the mural has a kind of, you know, folkloric look, you know, it's made by, I don't know, I can't remember the name of the muralist. It's in our credits
yeah.
right now, but it's, but, you know, but it's, it's not made by, you know, a political mural organization. It's made by, you know, maybe a local muralist who, you know, might be, I use the word amateurish. But, you know, so it has a kind of folkloric appeal to it, which I think was interesting for us, too. And so then we were researching Rizzo, and we thought, oh, even better, you know, that we set our accordionist in front of it. And then the moment after, of course, then we realize that Santo is sitting right below the mural as the accordionist walks away. So that's another moment in that film, yeah.
Yeah, and also it's just convenient that the Italian flag and the Mexican flag are the same colors. I mean, it's perfect. And also Rizzo, not to be confused with Anthony Rizzo from the Cubs. Go Cubs. I don't think there's
maybe
any
they're
relation.
Related. I don't know. Okay.
Yeah, so any other questions?
Yeah, Kenseth.
Kenseth?
So I don't even know if this can be answered, but I, you know, very few artists really work collaboratively and for a really long period of time. And then you guys have both neurotransmitter and then your collaborations, not as neurotransmitter. And then I wanted to know if you wanted to talk about a bit about how you differentiate how you collaborate as neurotransmitter from how you're collaborating now, and whether or not, you know, there's a significant difference in the practice. And then, you know, how that affects the relationship you have with sort of ongoing work.
Well, yeah, thank you for that. And, you know, neurotransmitter has been near and dear to our hearts. And publicly, I can say that we stopped working as neurotransmitter in 2008. And we kind of put that to rest. And now we consider it an archive. So if you go to neurotransmitter.fm, you'll see an amazing black and white website with video and sound and images that everything studio designed. And so we kind of situate that maybe more in the past, but you know, we're still being asked to maybe do a neurotransmitter piece here and there. That said, we're still really interested in radio and what radio can bring to artistic practice in terms of a new public, thinking about the airwaves as public space, and just the kind of phenomenological kind of sound object that it signifies, right? The sonorous object, which is radio. So that's that part. After 2008, we just began working under our own names and doing what you see here and what you'll see in the catalog.
And I guess I'll add to that. You know, I think this is it's a really big conversation, right? You know, the ideas around collaboration and how things. I mean, every collaboration is quite different. And I think one of the interesting things for us, too, was to work with Tom and Jessica, who are also collaborators, you know, in life and in work, you know. So I think, you know, we have, our lives overlap in so many ways. And I think it made sense, I think, in some way, like, maybe we got you got us, I don't know, you know. Like, we are the world. I don't know. But I think in terms of, I think neurotransmitter, it had its moment and it had its place and time, and it made sense for us, you know, for those 8 years that we were working, or seven, I guess it was 7 years, almost eight, that we were working under that moniker. And I think, you know, I think at some point we kind of felt limited by it and we wanted to explore other avenues. I mean, maybe now, you know, it's now 8 years later. Who knows? We're going to, you know, take on another persona, collaborative persona as well. But and sometimes that can happen. I think it happens to a lot of artists in which, you know, their work is framed in a particular way. And I think when your work, we felt we were working under this collaborative name. It was, you know, this is a kind of neurotransmitter work. You know, what happens if we do something that isn't, you know, that doesn't fit within that rubric of practice. But I also think that, you know, it was so specifically tied to the technology and the history and, you know, the activism of radio and radio was changing. You know, in 2008, things were really changing with the technology. And, you know, I teach radio and audio at the College of Staten Island. And, you know, some of my students, they don't turn on the radio, you know. They listen to podcasts or they Spotify, you know, all of these things. And so I think that the work that we were doing as neurotransmitter really marked a particular time in terms of the technology of it.
Also, you know, there are very few people who start out collaborating and then they move to another collaborator. So, generally speaking, you know, the people are, they get curious about their separate practices. Mm. Somebody breaks up the band, Justin Timberlake goes off. You know,
yeah, yeah.
So, you know, so that brings you to the third part of it, is like, you know, which one of you is JT? Probably that
one. Yeah, yeah.
I think I'm more like the Joey Fatone of the bunch. But yeah, I mean, these are, you know, we don't do it out of convenience because it's not really convenient. It would be more convenient if I was in my singular studio as a singular artist, right? That's convenient. So I don't know. There's a certain drive that we have or a certain way of working that we're kind of used to at this point.
Yeah, maybe we can ask you guys that question. We'll put it on the onus on you now. Well, yeah.
I had a question that maybe ties into this. Is it seems like you all, as collaborators, is that you always deal with other works that precede you, right, as a bit of collective work? So even you guys, right, there are musicians, there are artists that precede your work, and somehow by passing through you guys, yet become other works, you know. And what I find interesting is, you know, now neurotransmitter is now an archive, it is a thing. When at one point I might have thought of it as this active, like I can't, right, it's each one is a project, or, you know, but now we can think of it as a distinct historical moment, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And I feel like you all, I mean, even outside of this project, you all sort of adopt things that preceded you.
So everything is a cover.
But I guess maybe my question is, like, is there a point at which you sort of feel like that was, I mean, for you it must be this is the work, and then it changed, like there's the performance, then there's the video, then there's the show, then there's the archive. Does it feel like it's going through those phases?
Definitely the performance and the work, right? You know, and then I guess, yeah, the exhibition of the, well, the, I guess the work is also how we imagine it in exhibition, right? But we always see the performance of, the performance as being its own entity, and that's then documented in some way, and it becomes something else. So it's transformed through the work, through the video, or through the audio piece that we create, or the installation, or whatever it may be. So, but most often, I mean, even the radio play, the original version of the radio play was a performance. It was in Manifesta in Spain, so it was a live performance that was broadcast on the radio. And then recorded, and then the recording becomes a part of an installation, and then we created an English language version of it as well. So there are multiple iterations of that are existent within a work, right? I think that did I answer your question, Patrick? I don't know. Yeah.
Okay, well, I think we're just going to stop talking now and open it up into a mixer format. So thank you very much for being here and being a part of this.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Jessica. For joining us.